Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we have a very special guest. He's going to talk about his new book, Helpless. His name is Daniel Palmer. He's written a new book. It's published by Kensington Publishing. It's in hardcover. And it's just terrific. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. I have to remark about this cover, first of all. This is like, it is a very interesting cover. I assume this is supposed to be Tom on the cover. Tom kind of feeling helpless.
Yeah, you know, I when I first saw it, I kind of looked at it and I thought, huh, did I write a scene where there's a guy on a tree branch? And I went back through the book, and no, I didn't. But then I thought, you know what, it's a metaphor for helplessness. And so I think when you look at it from that standpoint, it's a very helpless-looking situation.
Right. Now, I think we all know that you're the son of Michael Palmer, the medical thriller writer.
Proud son of Michael Palmer's 18 right. New York Times bestsellers.
18? Is that what he's got, 18?
I think it's 18.
Well, he's not. He doesn't do medical.
It might be 17, and his new book is Oath of Office, which is coming out next week and guaranteed to be another blockbuster for him.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if people don't know that, they know it now. But do you feel that there's something with families, when the father writes, that the children somehow get the gene for writing? I mean, do you feel that is true?
Yeah, I mean, I had from as a young lad the desire to write, but never to write fiction. I wrote songs, so I was a musician and a songwriter.
Did you get your songs published?
I have. I've published songs. I've sold songs and licensed some to. The biggest I ever did was to J. Crew, licensed one of my songs for a commercial. But I've licensed them to some Spanish chemical company and couple other smaller deals, and you know I've recorded albums, sold music, but you know it's always been more of a hobby. But the idea of songwriting and just the writing process has been a part of my life since I was really very young. Since I was almost 10 or 11 years old is when I started. It wasn't until I was older, until I was in my 30s, that I thought about writing long fiction.
And it's not easy. I mean, obviously, just reading this book, Helpless, and this is one of those books that just gets better and better as it goes along. It just grabs you by the throat, literally grabbed me by the throat and just wouldn't let go. I mean, there's a point where you just have to know what's going on here.
Yeah, this book was very challenging to write.
Sexting is a very, very serious subject.
Yeah, the book deals with teen. It really begins with showing the reader how a teenage girl, with every intention to stay fully clothed during a conversation with her boyfriend, can end up in a situation where she is suddenly in a state of undress, taking pictures of herself that she shouldn't potentially be taking, and sending them on to her boyfriend, believing that those pictures are going to stay safe and his view only. And the point there is that the internet provides an outlet, a distribution outlet that's instantaneous and global. And once you send that image, it's out of your control, and there's nothing you can do to get it back.
How horrifying would it be to see your naked picture on the internet? I can't even imagine how that would feel.
The story evolved for me when I was originally going to write. I knew I was going to write a story about sexting. I like to find stories that explore the hidden perils of commonly used technology, and of course, nothing's more common than our cell phone.
And is that a common theme in all your books, or will it be?
It is, in the sense that I feel like that's an area where I can offer something unique and of value. So I'm a huge thriller reader and just a fan of the genre, and you know, I read Harlan Coben and Michael Connelly and Tess Gerritsen and Lisa Gardner and all the greats. I could just keep going on and on.
Right.
They all do such amazing work, and I was looking for something where I didn't see a lot of coverage. And I saw people writing about technology. I think Jeff Deaver is a guy who does kind of what I do.
Right.
In that we're trying to get under the covers of how the technology works, try to show the reader some of the inner workings without losing them in the jargon.
And actually scare the reader. And that's what you do get scared reading Helpless, because you realize this really could happen to anybody.
Yeah, I want to show the reader that it's by understanding the technology and then understanding its implications, that's where the fear comes. If you don't really understand it, it's hard to be afraid of it. But once you say, oh, that's how it works, and then you realize, oh, that's what happens, that's the repercussions, then you get the fear. And in fact, that's how the story evolved, because I thought, well, sexting's an interesting topic, but it wasn't scary enough. I thought, what's the worst that happens here? The picture ends up going around school and you're embarrassed. It's horrible, but is that going to carry me through a book? And I discovered in my research an organization within the FBI called the Innocent Image National Initiative. And these are the folks who investigate child pornography crimes. They're the ones, whenever you read about a child pornography ring being shut down, it's the Innocent Image National Initiative behind that.
It makes me wonder, well, first of all, how many kids are sexting nude images to their boyfriends and girlfriends? I mean, are there millions that are doing that?
Well, look, now there's some controversy. Some people, the statistic was around 40%, with somewhere around 60% to 70% of teens having been solicited by a stranger online, or some around those numbers, so very high. Now there's a recent report saying it's not as high as originally thought, but that survey that came out was a survey of teenagers, and it's hard to say how truthful that is. Were they at home? Were their parents within earshot when they were taking the survey?
Well, somebody's got to get through to these kids, warning them how really dangerous.
In fact, like a few months ago in Vermont, 25 kids were arrested for taking and distributing pictures of themselves amongst themselves. So the pictures allegedly didn't leave their circle, but all you have to do is Google the word sexting and Google the word school, and you'll see stories of images that are being sent around the internet and young people who are being arrested and charged as sex offenders for...
Where are these parents in all this? The parents, it's like, are we giving our phones as babysitters for our children?
Well, I think the problem is it's very difficult to monitor what your kids are doing online unless you set up...
And then you become the villain.
...guidelines, and then you become the villain. And in fact, in the book, there's that point where the father has to kind of question, how much rope do I give my kid? At what point have I just given them too much and they're now going to hang themselves, proverbially, of course. I think it's a difficult question for any parent to answer, is how protective should I be? And my recommendation is go on the safe side. Be a little more protective until you're in a situation where you really can't be a guardian of it. I would...
Become the villain. You have to
I would be the villain.
Right. You have to become a villain at some point with your children, because they're gonna look at you in that way at some point or another. If you really care about your kids, you'll do what's right.
Yeah, exactly. And so just back to the FBI's Innocent Image National Initiative. When I discovered this group, I thought, well, what happens if a sexted image of a teenage girl ends up on the computer of an alleged child pornographer? And I kind of traced the procedures. What would the FBI do? And the answer is the FBI would work to identify the child. That their job is to find out who is the child, is the child in immediate danger, and to identify and confirm whether or not there is a dangerous situation. So in this case, if the FBI can identify you from a photograph, they will show up at your house with a sanitized version of the image found. They will make you sign it. They will make you date it. And then you will write a victim impact statement, because you are now the victim of a sex crime. And that victim impact statement will last forever.
Well, so, I mean...
file. And right. Anytime your image shows up as evidence in another child pornography case, your impact statement could be read at court during sentencing.
And let's be frank here. People are more likely to believe something bad about you than something good. I mean, it just seems like the mere suggestion of things can be very damaging.
Well, that's definitely the other theme of the book is, so as dangerous as it is to take a picture of yourself and shoot it out to the internet, not knowing if where it's going to end up, and if it could end up in the clutches of a child pornographer in the case of sexting, the other aspect of the novel is, how easy is it to destroy your reputation? And once it's destroyed, it's irreparably destroyed. So if I say, here's a sexted image of a teenage girl, here's a soccer coach from a high school soccer team, I'm alleging that the soccer coach is coercing the girl into taking the pictures and then selling them online. You've got a scandal of fairly epic proportions right there. And once you make that allegation, you are branded forever in the community as a child pornographer.
If you go on any pornographic website, I mean, you're always taking a chance that there might be children underage. I wonder, you know, all these people that go on there, if they actually look at those things. And I mean, is that against the law to look if it's on there illegally?
What's interesting, just today, there's an article, I think it's in the New York Times, about fair trade practices, where there's Fair Trade for Coffee, which certifies that the creation of the coffee was done within fair trade labor practices. And there's now a movement to say they should do the same thing with those types of images to assure that the people are of age and of consent.
Right. But I wonder if you're breaking the law if you don't know it. I mean,
a lot of times what the criminals complain when they're arrested, what their defense is my computer was infected. I got a virus, and the virus downloaded these images to my machine. And the reality is that happens, and it happens frequently. There is a case of a prisoner who was running a child pornography distribution ring from prison using viruses that he distributed and basically infected a bunch of different computers. And so innocent people were literally acting as a web host to distribute child pornography any knowledge whatsoever.
This is a really, you know, it's not a subject that's easy to talk about.
It was difficult to write about. Like, some of the stuff I wrote about, I thought, wow, I really wish I didn't have to put this in print.
Yeah, I guess at some point you must have felt like, I need to take a shower.
You feel horrible. And what's interesting is the character Rainey in the novel is an FBI agent with the FBI's Innocent Image National Initiative.
Are you going to tell me she's real somewhere? Is there somebody
absolutely.
Just like Rainey?
She's absolutely real. And in fact,
you sure this book is fiction, Dan?
Well, this book, the plot is fiction. The plot's wild. You know, that's part of my job, which is to create something that's going to be entertaining, enthralling, and surprising. So I do, you know, I can weave a complex web, but hopefully it doesn't read complex. So by the time you're done with it, you followed the story, and you're like, wow, I did not expect it to go there.
Well, at some point, the book becomes just totally enthralling. It just, you can't wait to see what's going to happen next, and you're like stuck in a spider web. It's so interesting, and I found that it does build slowly at first, and
because there's pieces that get put into place, and it was a decision that I had to make is how fast can I get to the heart. You know, I think the real turning point in the novel is when the police officer of the small town comes up and says, hey, there's a blog post. And he comes up to the soccer practice. So it's a soccer coach and his 20-something girls for the soccer team that he's coaching in. And the police officer says, hey, there's a blog post that's popped up on the internet that's alleging that you're having sexual relations with one of your players.
Can you imagine that?
And this post is purely anonymous. It's untraceable. And all it is an allegation. Now, when I talked to my local police, because I went to my local police and I said, what would happen if a blog post pops up on the internet alleging this crime? And he said, well, we would try to prove whether or not it was a prank. I said, well, how would you do that? And he said, we'd question the girls. And I was like, oh my goodness. The second that you bring up coach and sex in the same sentence, it's over. The town's going to think you're doing it. You're going to be proven guilty.
Despite how much they liked you before.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You're instantly going to be guilty. And so I had this scene of the girls being lined up and the police officer going down the line saying, Have you? Who made the prank? Who posted this thing? Who's trying to get the coach in trouble? Almost with the intention of it seeming like, hey, we're trying to help the coach out, but really, you're doing the coach an incredible disservice because now his name has just been associated with a sex crime, and his reputation is now tarnished. And so that's where I think the book really just kind of...
Well, were you afraid at all to write this book? I mean, was there a fear that A, people would be afraid to read it, B, that it would be too scary, too real life?
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't ever like to go outside of the potential of it being real. To me, that's what makes these books fun. Mm-hmm. So I would never want to write a story that didn't...
Fun and good entertainment, yes, absolutely.
But, you know, I'm a huge Greg Iles fan.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like he never pulls a punch. And so I said, I'm not going to pull any punches. I'm going to write it the way it is. So the police officer, the FBI agent, Rainey, who I used as a real-life person, she does this job day in and day out. She will hunt down child pornographers.
And one has to wonder how you do that day to day to day.
And so when I wrote about her mood, and I said it's just distressing, and you can't have relationships, and you can't sleep sometimes, that's not a lie. That's what these folks sometimes endure. It's fairly brutal, and you know there's no end in sight to the behavior.
And you actually have scenes in here where she's looking through all these images online. She's got to determine, you know, what's going on and whether it's bad, whether it's illegal.
Well, to write that part of the book, but I felt like I needed to.
Well, you got to be at some point. You got to be honest with your audience, your readers.
This
you know
is what the job is. This is what happens. It doesn't go away all nice and neat. That every single one of these images is going to be cataloged. It's going to be classified. It's going to be registered. There's a giant database of these images. That there's ways of matching these images so that they could say, well, we got this image from another source, and there's a whole procedure built in around it. So I really wanted the book to be procedurally accurate.
I must admit, though, I mean, the more I read the book, the more I realized what a great storyteller you really are. And I felt when I was done the book, I went on to read the next book, I was missing the way you told a story, which I really enjoyed. I mean, there's such an intricacy in this book of a story that is just so wonderful to read.
I really appreciate that. That. To be honest, that's the highest compliment you can pay a writer, which is you're a great storyteller.
And to tell a great story is not easy. I don't care what anybody says, it's not an easy task. And I mean, just because James Patterson has 10 books a year, you know, whatever he does, whether he has collaborators or whatever, that's very difficult to do, and you could not possibly write 10 books yourself, you know. And it's,
I think James Patterson is a terrific storyteller. He will rivet you. He'll create great suspense. I mean, you could like his books or not like his books, but you can't deny the suspense. You can't deny that.
What's extra good about Helpless is you flesh out the characters so well. I mean, we feel like we know Tom. Tom's like the all-American guy, and, you know, we feel for him, you know?
Yeah. What I wanted with Tom was...
Well, what would that... To be a pariah in society, it's something we all... I mean...
I toned it down, to be honest with you. When I originally wrote Tom, I thought, well, what would happen to me in my town? So the book is set in a fictitious New Hampshire town called Shiloh, New Hampshire.
Right.
But I'll tell you this, that if you mix up those letters and add one, that you'll get my hometown. That's how I came up with the name Shiloh. It's based in my town. It's where I live.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Now everybody's trying to scramble to figure out.
Yeah, you can do it. Have fun. Have fun with the game. Figure it out and then send me a letter and tell me that you found it. But I wanted to set it in a real setting. I wanted it to feel real, and I thought, well, what would happen to me? And I thought, well, if I go to the grocery store, who's going to look at me? If I go down the street, who's going to really be my friend? Who's going to support me? And so when I was writing the book, his being ostracized from his community, I painted it as even worse than it was. And I toned it down because I realized that he was friendless. And nobody wants to read about a friendless guy.
At some point with your main character, you can't do too much for him, or you know, you can't against him, or you know, in reality, you know, people are killing themselves over stuff like this. The humiliation can be
just permanently scarring. So I toned it down, but it's very, you know, I think it does. As you read the book, you start to feel, you empathize with this guy. You know he's innocent, and yet you can see the reaction people have to him around the community.
And on some level, you get angry with the people around him that they so easily would believe this stuff, you know, and they do. People easily believe a lot of things, and it's really awful.
With this particular crime, you are guilty in the eyes of the public before your trial. All you have to do is be accused, and you are guilty. And you know, I'm not trying to write a book that says 99% of the people who are arrested for the crime of possessing child pornography are innocent. In fact, if you look at in Massachusetts right now, there are 4 athletic coaches working with boys and girls who have been arrested and accused of child pornography.
Oh, that's terrible.
In the past 2 weeks, it's incredibly disturbing. The reason that I chose to make my character an athletic coach isn't because I thought it doesn't happen. It's because I wanted my character to be the most vulnerable. And I think that if you work with children, if you work, especially if you're a male working with girls, you are really, really vulnerable to this kind of an attack.
So now that you've done all this research, I don't know, how old are your children?
Oh, I have a son who's 7 and a daughter who's 4.
Now, what would you ever let them have a cell phone, even after reading about all this?
You know, I have, my son now can go on the internet and he can go to websites and go and do, like, you know, he goes to this math website and plays these games and has fun. And I'm thinking, wow, how did he learn all that? They learn so quickly. My daughter, she can just take my cell phone and access applications.
Mm.
I'm like, really? How did you learn how to do that? So it's pretty amazing what they learn. So you think that they're safe, that they'll be safe with it, and they actually can get around. So I doubt that my kids are going to have laptops in their room or computers in their room, and I doubt that they're going to have...
Uh-oh, Dad's going to be a villain.
Cell phones with picture capability.
I wouldn't blame you in the slightest. I think you're doing... I mean, I think the trick... I mean, and not being a parent, I'm not an expert here, but I mean, I think if you bring up your children right, I mean, I can't imagine them doing stuff like that. But I mean, I don't know. Even that, you know, there's so much going on in so many ways that you can be talked into things, even if you think it's wrong.
Well, that's the opening scene of the story. This girl in the opening pages, she's a good girl. She's follows the rules. She's got a great GPA. She's on an athletic team. She's planning for college, and she's in love with a boy, and the boy manipulates her. This isn't about her wanting to be boastful. This isn't wanting to be showy. This is her not wanting to lose the affections of a boy, and she does this to thinking that it's going to keep him.
Peer pressure. It's that stinking
pressure.
Peer.
And that's it really is a way that it can happen.
And what I mean, and when you think about it, is there more? Are children more? Are the parents more of an influence, or are their friends more of an influence? That I mean, and that's a big question.
Are the parents or the children? Yeah, I mean, I think it's that.
Their friends. Their friends are. The friends can be such pressure. I mean, you don't want. Nobody wants to be left out. We're a society of people that don't want to be left out of things.
Yeah, the only thing I think that you can do as a parent is to just keep the dialogue going. You open the dialogue, you talk about it, you talk about the dangers, you talk about your concerns, you talk about the repercussions of certain behavior.
I mean, why are male children so, why are they so introverted sometimes? Why are they afraid to talk to their parents about things?
You know what, I think a lot of teens, so again, in writing this book, I wanted to capture the teenagers accurately as well, and you'll notice they don't use a lot of words, and that's my experience. That's just because that's my experience of engaging. When an adult is engaging a teenager, the words decrease. When it's a teen talking to a teen, they talk and talk and talk. So part of what we do as parents, we will talk. The teen may not respond, but we don't know how much they're taking in, And so you've got to just keep talking. In fact, I think it's fine to talk to your kids about alcohol, drugs, at a very young age. Talk about smoking at a young age. And the kids will begin to form an impression that when the time comes and they're forced to make a decision, do I take a drink, do I take a drag, I remember what my parents said, you know what, I'm going to pass.
Yeah.
Hope.
Absolutely. What's your biggest fear as a parent with your children?
Oh, you know, I think...
Or are there multiple fears?
I don't think it's... I try not to get swallowed up into fear thinking. There's a great book on the... I have to look it up. The Science of Fear, I think it is.
Right.
Which is... It's called, The Science of Fear, our Culture of Fear. And it's...
Would a better word be worry?
It's the worry. You want your kids to be happy. You want your kids to be happy. That's the main thing. I just want my kids to be happy, and so I'm trying to do what I can on a daily basis to give them every opportunity to be the kids they want to be and do the things they want to do that bring them joy, and you love them, and that's, I think, all you can do as a parent. Support your kids and hope for the best. It's definitely life's big unknown.
Well, and in a moment of weakness, anybody could do things like this. I mean, you could. I don't know. There's so many things that can go wrong. I mean, you have to watch what you do all the time. You have to think ahead. You know, what if this gets out? What if things are
out of hand? That's a very good point. And part of what I talk about in the book, or what one of the characters talked about, Rainey, the FBI agent, does a public address to the student assembly. And she basically tells these kids, listen, what you do online does not come with an expiration date, that there's no shelf life for your internet behavior. The comments you leave, all of these things become a reflection of you, and over time they accumulate, and they create an online persona that you will be judged by. And you'll be judged by it when you apply to college. You'll be judged by it when you apply for a job. You'll be judged by it when you try to go out on a date and that person Googles you. Or now they don't even have to Google you. They have websites that are essentially reputation analyzers. You put in your name of the person you're going to go out on a date with, and they'll say, well, here's what we found about that person. Here's what they've said. Here are some of the comments they've left on blogs. Here are some of the pictures that they've posted. Here's what they've pinned on Pinterest. Here's what they've tweeted. Here's our assessment, or your clout score, if you will, for dating. It's we're being indexed, and we're being classified, and we're being ranked by every single thing that we do.
Is the plan to have every one of your books end with the letter S and be one word?
Did I do that again?
Yes. Delirious and helpless. They both end in S's, and they're both
one
word.
Oh, well, I have...
Is there something with that? I mean, are you thinking of that when you're thinking of these titles, or does this just make it one word?
My agent at one point said, oh, I love one-word titles.
Uh-huh.
So I said, oh, well...
We can blame your agent.
I'm good at that. So I have these three. All right, Delirious, Helpless, and the one I'm doing now is called Stolen.
Stolen. No, that's different. No S at the end.
No
that
S.
Sounds different.
But it's still one letter.
But
still one word, I mean.
I mean, I have no problem with the titles. They kind of, I mean, Helpless definitely gives you an idea of what the character's feeling. I mean, that's definitely what Tom is feeling.
Yeah, that's the main, and, you know, this is a guy who's not used to feeling helpless. He's a former Navy SEAL, and I chose to make him former Special Forces because, you know, you have 400 pages of a book, and the guy's got to do something more than dribble a soccer ball around the bad guys.
Right.
But I didn't want to write a caricature of a Special Forces guy. And, you know, it's certainly not a...
And it's got to sound... The title has to sound like a thriller. It can't sound really hokey.
Right.
It couldn't be like Tom's Plight or something. That would sound really stupid.
That would be very...
Stupid. But, I mean, it's like... You don't want it to sound really silly, and it's got to be direct to the point and grab the reader.
Yeah, and the way, you know, the way it looks on the book cover with the word helpless in lowercase font and in the, you know, just running through the midsection of the guy or through the guy's body on the tree. I think it looks pretty sharp.
Now, do you agonize over every sentence?
That's a great question. The answer is I can't.
Oh, really?
I can't.
But you, I mean, your story flows very nicely. It isn't, you know, it doesn't feel like it's...
I agonize over the flow. And I think this is where songwriting's helped me. It's a rhythm. I hear a rhythm in my head. And when I read, after everything I write, I read it out loud. And I look for things that it's less about a word or a phrase or the perfect word. It's more about, does it ring true? And so when I give it to a reader, so one of my best readers is my mother. She is phenomenal. So for a couple reasons, she's brilliant, very smart. She does not read thrillers. She loves to read. Mm-hmm. She does not read thrillers. She reads more literary fare.
Except your stuff.
I'm a kid. She definitely reads my stuff. But she reads it, and when she comes across something, it's not... She'll come across something and either say, I stumbled here, or this doesn't ring true. And that's what I look for. It's that rhythm or that thing that doesn't ring true. And as long as I don't have those happening in the book, I'm going to keep moving forward.
Now, the fact that at first I thought it was a little slow, is there a point to the fact that when you start writing a book that it has to build slowly in the beginning? I mean, is that true of all of your books, do you think?
Well, I think for one reason and one reason only, which is I'm not writing series characters. So if I was writing a series character, let's say I was writing a detective or a lawyer, the book can start with a crime, and we're right in the story. And there was no build-up, because you expect that there is going to be some kind of crime surrounding this individual. This person is involved. You know, I just read Karen Slaughter's new book, Fallen.
Oh, yeah.
That book opens up with quite the bang. Mm-hmm. There's a home invasion and a mass slaughter. And that happens to the main character, because that main character is an FBI agent. And so my challenge when I'm writing the books I'm writing now is that the situation is evolving around the person. And so it takes some time to evolve it. And I have to come up with other ways of holding the tension and showing the tension as the tension's building and as I'm ratcheting it up. And it's you know, it's a difficult thing to do sometimes.
And it also seems that the faster the authors write, the less you can flesh out the characters. I mean, I know some authors are writing two or three books a year now, and you read them, and sometimes the story's really great, and you're really enjoying the story, but the characters are just not coming out of the page yet. You're not believing they're real people. You're just believing it's a story. And I mean, sometimes I feel that way, and it's a shame, because the characters are so important.
I mean, oh, yeah.
You've got to make these characters real. You've got to make people feel for these characters, you know, and believe that they're real people. And it's not an easy thing to do. I mean,
I don't know where that comes from, because I do know that when the stuff I tend to read, I read a lot of stuff that's, you know, written by commercially successful writers, because mm-hmm. I'm very curious how they did it. Why are their books so commercially successful? And I find a common theme, which is these characters are really good, and they tend to make them come alive. And that's the stuff I gravitate towards. That's what keeps me glued to the page. You know, you're not turning... People think that they're turning the page because they want to know what happens next, but subconsciously they're turning the page because they care about the character and want to know what happens to them.
But also the question is, with readers, I mean, how much leeway they're going to give you. If they open the page and they're not hooked within the first 10, 15 pages, they're going to close the book. I mean, that's what you have to think about. So in some level, you have to tell a story that's going to hook the reader pretty quickly, but it's also got to ring true. I mean,
right. And that's, I think, the key and the only, you know, so... There's obviously going to be some subjectivity to it, you know, were you hooked, were you interested? But the other thing that I try to do with every page, with every interaction, with every chapter, is conflict. And what I try to do is to not resolve it. That I set it up and it's not resolved. And if I can do that well enough, then you're going to keep kind of plugging along and say, well, what is going on? What is happening here? What is the conflict? And that's how you kind of can grip the reader and keep things moving.
Now, do you think you know all the tricks now, or are you learning as you write each book new tricks that you didn't know before?
This is just, you know, feeling your way through the dark with you know, not even sure where you're trying to get to.
But Helpless doesn't read that way. Helpless reads like it's a writer who knows what he's doing.
And I hope so.
it definitely does. I can't tell, coming from somebody who's already read the book and enjoyed it, and you know, that's the way it reads.
I feel like I've you know, sometimes, so as a musician, I've always kind of considered myself, that's my art. Music's my art. And it's very free that way. I'll write a song and I'll just keep noodling on it. Like, then I'll obsess over every nuance of my song from an artistic perspective.
I wonder how you feel. And do you actually get to hear your song after it's been written and somebody's recorded it? I mean,
I've recorded my own stuff and it sounds great. But the difference is with fiction writing, I feel like with this particular type of fiction writing, I feel like I'm a craftsman. And I'm learning, I've learned a craft. I've learned how to do a certain thing and hopefully to do it well and hopefully to continue to improve. But I feel like when you pick up a thriller novel, it's like you've gone to a store to buy a bowl, right? You know what a bowl is. You know what it looks like. But every single person who makes a bowl could make it slightly different. And so I feel like I've learned the elements of the craft to know how to make a bowl so that you'll read my book and say, wow, this is a thriller. I was completely engaged. I had a great time. I was turning the pages. I was getting paper cuts. And yet at the same time, you get something unique that's specific to me. And I think that's what I've learned is just the craft. And the more I do it, the better the craft is going to get. And so I think hopefully the books continue to improve as I continue to write.
Now, this book is 406 pages, which is even more remarkable that's, I mean, you've got to engage that reader for 406 pages. And you can't, now, of course, I guess on the last page you could probably not, I mean, by the last page, of course they're interested, but to tell a story that's going to be that interesting for that length of time, I can't even imagine what that would feel like to do that. I mean, it's easy to think of an idea, but to flesh it out completely and have it sound completely plausible is so difficult.
Yeah, I'm getting to that point where I'm not sure where the craft is coming into play. There's like an instinct that's kicking.
Well, do you think you were just born talented as a writer? Do you think that the talent was there when you were born?
Well, it took me, in order to get published, about 10 years, about a million words written, and then I could publish a book.
A million words?
Definitely.
Wow.
Definitely.
See, that's what we don't know. We're just reading your two books, and we think, well, this guy's a natural. You know, where's he been all these years?
Yeah. There's a huge kind of learning curve, and I still feel like that learning curve is in front of me. Like, I haven't mastered it. I'm not... You know, when I look at the masters, I look at, you know, I read Lee Child's book, I'm in awe. I read Michael Connelly stuff, I'm in awe.
Right.
Harlan, I'm in awe.
But are you in awe of yourself?
John Hart, no, not awe.
I had to ask that question. I just felt the need.
Oh, I feel like if I could, if people pick it up and they say, wow, this worked on the same level as a Lee Child book or on the same level as a Michael Connelly book, I'm just beyond delighted.
I wish we could get Michael Connelly on to ask his opinion of it. But, you know, I think you've got... Don't you have people in the back who... I thought there were some... Oh, Lisa Scottolini.
Oh, yeah.
Andrew Gross.
Lisa Scottolini, Andrew Gross.
Lisa Gardner, who's a sweetie. And Steve Barry.
They all love the book, but I still don't... You know, I don't view myself like that. I look up to these folks and have admired their work. And, you know, I can only hope that my career continues on an upward trajectory and people discover my books and say, wow, you know what, this guy is, he's in that league. He belongs with these folks. I guess, you know, Eli Manning said it, right, with Tom Brady. He's like, I belong in the same league as Tom. So, you know, the book's published, it's out there. I guess I belong in that league. with the other guys who are.
But you don't sound like you're fully convinced of that.
Well, you know, I guess maybe I should. Maybe I'll change my tune and just say, yeah, I belong.
Of course.
I make bowls, like, as good as Lee Child.
Well, all I can say is the fact that I read both books from beginning to end and enjoyed both books, that says a lot, because I'm a very picky reader.
Well, that's perfect. You know what?
And then I'm not saying I'm the expert. I'm the big expert. But I'm just saying that's difficult because I am very picky about what I read.
Well, I will say that, you know, this particular book, I was pretty psyched that Publishers Weekly gave it a starred review, that Library Journal did the same, and that there's just been a lot of positive feedback about the book. And so I hope that, you know, I hope that people discover it, people read it, and people have that kind of reaction to it. I've gotten some great early feedback from my readers, and I'm building a fan base of kind of loyal readers of my books, and I hope I can...
They should let you do a YouTube video of it. Have they done that yet?
A YouTube video of...
Like a publicity thing for the book. You know, have somebody, you know, that a lot of people see stuff on YouTube.
Yeah, I tried to do it. I was going to do a little reading,
mm-hmm.
and I recorded it, and I didn't like it very much. I was like, really? It just doesn't look right. I needed better lighting. I don't know. Maybe I'll try again, and I'll put something up there.
Maybe you could send it to Stephen King. He could write a column about it too. You know? This is one of the better books to read this year.
He's my when it comes to the pantheon of my favorites, he sits at the top.
I wonder what he'd think of Helpless. I think he'd really like Helpless. I think he'd really think it was really. I mean, it's not a horror novel, so I mean, he doesn't only like horror novels.
No, he's so beyond that. He's such the thing about Stephen King, for me is again, it goes back to that. When I read his stuff, I'm not reading him as a writer. I'm reading him as a storyteller, and he's so amazing. I just finished reading his latest book,
11/22/63, which is it's fantastic.
Fantastic. I mean, talk about engaging somebody for over 1,000 pages.
But yet again, the first part of it I thought was very slow. So, I mean, it maybe that is a theme with authors. Maybe they do start out slow.
Yeah, when you can't start out with a crime, you've got to start somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're spot on. I think it's very tough. I think it's very tough to do. That's why prologues often are so important.
Mm-hmm.
Because the prologue gives you an opportunity to have a pretty wild beginning. My father's book that's coming out in a week, Oath of Office, that book starts out with a doctor going into his office and basically taking a gun out and blowing away the entire staff.
Oh, wow. That's a good beginning. Now, but your Helpless doesn't have a prologue.
It doesn't. I abandoned the prologue, and I went.
Well, what was going to be in the prologue?
Well, the way I was originally going to do it was a letter. It was going to be a confessional of a crime that had been committed in the past.
Because I'm not a big fan of prologues, and the reason that they annoy me so much is because a lot of times they give away something that's going to happen in the book, or they'll hint at something, and you're like, what does that mean? And now I'm annoyed because I've started the book, and I'm not sure why this is in there.
Yeah, the prologue, the book...
But that's just me, because there's too many prologues. People must like them because they put them in so many books.
The book I'm writing now does have a prologue.
Oh, really?
Okay. And it doesn't have any... It's not going to impact the plot.
It's not like 35 pages, is it?
No. Sure. I will send you this prologue, and you can tell me that you don't like it, but I pretty much guarantee you...
Daniel, I like you as a writer, and I think I'm going to like every book I read.
This prologue will be pretty mind-blowing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're very high on this book, Stolen, and now I can't wait to read it. I mean,
I'm really excited. I'm having such a great time writing it.
But, I mean, have you ever read a prologue that just went on and on and on? You're like, get to the story,
you know,
will you?
Then I lose it. I do. I give up. I'll confess that I give up on books. So if I'm not, I don't feel like I have anything to prove
We better not mention which books you've given up on. Well, we're liable to offend somebody.
Yeah, no, I would never. But it's happened. You know, I'll
mention this. I'm reading a book now and I don't like flashbacks and flash forwards. And this book flashes forward to the trial already going on, and then it flashes back before the trial. It really annoys the heck out of me for some reason. I feel like I've missed something already, and I don't like that feeling. I want to be there from page one all the way to the end of the book. I want to everything that happens to be in front of me, and I don't want it to be backward or forward. That just annoys the heck out of me. Now, maybe that's just me.
I haven't thought about writing a book with that kind of structure. I'm reading Robert Crace's book, Taken.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And it's built into different sections, and there are some things that happen from the narrative standpoint that don't happen linearly. But Robert Crace is so masterful.
Yeah, he's a good writer.
That you just don't. It's just.
And the trick is,
and he's done it so well. But I'm pretty sure that he worked really hard to make it as good as he's made it.
And the trick is, when you write different series, he's got a couple. He's got Elvis Cole and he's got Joe Pike. The trick is to make each one interesting. Like I with John Sanford, I love his Lucas Davenport series, but I haven't gotten into anything else he's written, and I don't know why. I like Lucas Davenport.
Yeah, I haven't been reading John Sanford's books, and I just read one not too long ago and was completely blown away.
But what do you hope to get? What do you hope to have happen with each book? Do you feel like you're going to grow as a writer? Do you feel like by book 17 you'll be a Stephen King?
Oh. I don't know. The thing right now, I'm not leaving my space of. So Stephen King wrote.
Well, what does he have that you don't have?
Oh well, I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't compare myself to.
But I mean, what does he? What I mean, you both have the ability to tell really good stories. I mean, but you obviously feel he's in a class by himself.
I think what is amazing to me about him, outside of his style, is his imagination. His imagination is just, it's boggling.
It's boundless, is what it is. There's just nothing. I mean, he's writing the sequel to The Shining, which I didn't even know he was going to do.
Oh, it's incredible. I didn't know that either.
But
his imagination is so boundless that I guess what I hope is, as a writer, that I continue to mine rich material. I just, as long as I have the stories and I have good stuff to tell, That's all I really hope for. You know, in addition to having people who want to read the stories so that I could continue to do this.
And with Helpless, I feel like, you know, this is an important book that a lot of people should read. And definitely, if you're a parent, you should definitely read this book. Because
that's the message that that I've heard from other readers who said, wow, I put this book down and the first thing I wanted to do was talk to my kids about it or to share this with a teen. And I think it's written in a way that if you are a younger person, you would have no problem reading this book, and you would enjoy reading this book because it's got it's got something for everybody. It has a wide appeal.
Now, are you going to continue to write songs, or are you focused on your writing career now?
Well, it just comes in spurts. Right now, my musical performance is limited to basically parody songs about writing that I write and perform with my father at various conventions and our book.
Oh, you perform with your father? I didn't know that.
Yeah, we go. So we're going on tour. We're going on a little mini book tour.
Now, will you go? Will you do it at ITW? Will you play together at ITW?
We will. We'll play at the benefit. We're doing a song to the tune of The Cat's in the Cradle.
Oh, really?
Appropriate because it's a father-son type song. And
so it's already been written?
Performing it. It's in process.
Oh, wow, that's exciting.
A little book tour, so I'm going to be in Atlanta and South Carolina and North Carolina and a couple of places in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, and I'm doing all of the dates with my father, and because his book's coming out around the same time, so I think we'll end up performing these songs at these book conferences.
Well, I hope it goes on YouTube. I'd like to see it. I don't usually get to ITW, but I would love to go. Sometime I don't know if they allow internet interviewers on in ITW. I guess they do. As long as
they definitely
pay you away. But the chance to read so many to meet so many brilliant writers, and there are so many brilliant writers out there. I mean,
yeah, I mean that's my discovery as well, which is there's just so much talent. I love being a part of this community because I'm constantly in awe of the talent in the community that I'm a part of. So
do you really fear? We don't talk about it, not fear, but do you really worry that sometime you won't have the talent to write anymore? I mean, does that go through your head sometimes?
Yeah. It's not the talent to write; it's the idea.
Don't run out of ideas, do you?
Well, I used to laugh that's a very common question where people say, "Where do you get your ideas?" And I keep thinking, well, I don't know. I just get them.
Do you ever wake up and have a great idea?
That's what happened with the book I'm writing now. I saw the book in front of the refrigerator. I was getting like a yogurt. I was like, whoa, no, that's what this book can be. And it was like that aha moment.
Now, do you when you get that idea, do you bounce that off you, Kensington? Does everybody know about it, or do you just tell your agent, or how does that work?
Oh, yeah, it goes through a whole smoothing out process.
Does everybody have to say it's okay? I mean, what if you have two or three that say that it's fine, and the other one says, I hate the idea? Then what do?
Well, I tend to listen to the one who pays the bills, so... wherever that opinion comes from, you know, I would never, if somebody I admire these people and I respect their opinion, and if they came back and said, this is flawed, I'm not going to stand up and say, well, you're wrong. I'm going to sit down and think, well, why are they saying it's flawed? And 10 times out of 10, I can find the reason.
And one other thing with your books, the great thing is people don't have to read them in order. You can read now. Delirious is out in paperback now. You can read that anytime you want. You don't have to read one before the other.
Yeah. There's no. These are just purely standalones, and the third one I'm doing is a standalone.
Would you ever do a series?
If I find the right character.
Do you have an idea for a character now, even as we speak?
I've been contemplating one. I think it has to be involved in computer forensics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been kind of contemplating that. I think it's going to become trendy, is my guess. I think other people are contemplating the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to see what comes out and what people are writing to see if there's room for a character that I'm...
And I forgot to mention that. You actually did a lot of websites before. You did like the Barnes & Noble website?
That's where my background is as a tech guy. So I'm kind of former computer guy turned novelist, but my job as a techie, I was never the guy writing code. My job was to interpret what the code writers did. I interpreted that for the business people, so I was what's called a product manager. So I designed websites, I designed how the sites are supposed to function, and I kind of communicated the tech stuff up to the business people, which is why when you read Helpless or you read Delirious and I talk about technology, I did my very, very best to make it very understandable so that you don't get lost in the jargon and it doesn't seem like you can't follow it.
Yeah, I'm just in awe of people that can write. I mean, it's such a hard process. I mean, I don't do it, and I know it's difficult. Just hearing authors talk about it and knowing that every page has got to be good.
It's not that every page. It's not, and, I hope I was clear about that. It's not that I labor. I could go back through my book and there's a great quote. My father has a great quote about it. I can't remember who said it, but it was what you want. The second that book gets published, you can't control the compulsion to want to get it back and fix it up. But you have to let it go. You have to let the book be done.
Well, that's the question. When do you know when it's done? I mean, when do you know when there's nothing more you can do to it?
You have to believe that every page, every chapter, every interaction is rife with character, conflict, tension, and stakes. And that's what I go for in these books. I read it, reread it, edit it, until I'm sure that conflict and the tension and the character and the stakes involved is as crystal clear as I can make it. And that's what makes these books compelling. You know, having written novels and having produced and written CDs of music, full-length CDs. The writing of a novel is the hardest thing I've ever done, by far. It's really difficult.
It is, and it's a lonely job too. You're sitting in your office, and you need time to yourself, and you have to write, and it's a lot of pressure.
I want to feel lonely, but I feel like my day goes by so fast that I'm quite stunned that when I sit down to work, how fast the hours have gone, and sometimes how not productive the hours have been spent.
Right. But it's good that your books are substantial. I mean, they are 400 pages, and so there is time for you to really tell a great story, and that's what makes your book so good. So.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I'm contracted. My publisher is specific about the length.
They are? How about that?
I am to write a book that is of at least or roughly 100,000 words.
Well, how many words is Helpless? Do you know?
Helpless is longer.
Do you know the exact number?
120,000.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, it was a longer book, and that was actually a question that we had with it. There was some worry that it was too long, and should I cut it?
I think it's great the way it is. I mean, I wouldn't change anything about it. I really do. I think it's fine.
You know, and it's. You know, when you write a book like this, you have subplots, and you have that's the kind of stuff that keeps the middle from sagging. The book I'm writing now doesn't really have any subplots.
Is it also going to be 400 pages?
It could be around that.
You don't really know for sure.
I don't quite know at this point.
You ever find yourself when you pick a book up looking to see how long the book is? I think I do it more than I probably should, but...
Yeah, I mean, if it looks really meaty, and it's got really tiny print, then I get nervous. But then again, you know, I've got right now on my bookshelf, I'm reading The Pillars of the Earth, and that book can't be long enough.
And another point with writing is, I don't want... When I read a book, I don't want it to be too... I mean, Sally walked across the room, Sally did this, or whoever we're talking about. I want the story to be what I'm focused on. I don't want to be focused on what color the carpeting is necessarily.
Yeah, well, I'm not even very good at that. I've read, you know, like when I read Alice Hoffman, I'm in awe of her ability to describe.
Some people do it beautifully, and some people, it sounds clunky.
You know, there's certain times in life where you try to play to your weakness, but not with writing. I think with writing, what you want to do is play to your strength. And I think writers who know what their strengths are emphasize those strengths in their book. I think I know what my strengths are as a writer, and that's what I try to emphasize. And I try to stay away from color of the carpet, the size of the room, the shape of the...
If you do it right, it doesn't sound bad. I mean, they say James Lee Burke does that. He describes every detail.
But, you know, you read, it's just you want to keep reading it because you love how he writes it.
But I guess, you know, the reader doesn't want to be bored, too, though. I mean, if you have too much description, you could easily bore the reader.
And, unless you're James Lee Burke, in which case you're writing recipes and you're not going to bore anybody.
But people have trusted him by now. I mean, he's so famous now. I mean, everybody trusts him. Everybody knows that they're going to get a good story and that they may have to wait for it, but it's there.
Yeah, there's a writer, John Hart, who I feel kind of walks that territory of James Lee Burke. You know, his prose is pretty remarkable and beautiful, and yet he's writing, you know, these pretty...
And you can't be repetitive either. That's another thing. I mean, you can't repeat the same phrases over and over in your book. Everything's got to be new and fresh, and that's not easy. I mean,
In fact, I was wondering if there was a software application that told you what words you've used more than 10 times. That would be helpful for me.
All right. But see, then here again, Stephen King gets away with that. Now, he'll use the same phrase 25 times in the book, but it's effective.
Yeah.
For some reason, it works for him, and he can get away with it. But I find that a lot of writers can't get away with that.
Oh yeah, I think it's
like Redrum and his it's repeated how many times in I guess it's The Shining.
In The Shining, yeah.
One of those books. I mean, it's repeated over and over and over and over again. But it's Stephen King, and he can get away with it, and we expect that of him too.
I haven't read that book in quite some time.
But he has all kinds of phrases that repeat themselves all over his books. things that people say that are repeated over and over and over again.
Well, I took to heart, in order, I think, you know, I credit Stephen King with at least getting me into the game and hopefully keeping me in this fabulous profession.
Right.
You know, in his book, The Craft, The Ode to the Craft on Writing,
right.
You know, he said that the only way to do this job is to read a lot and write a lot. And that's the only piece of advice I've ever really carried forward. I just write it short and to the point,
yeah.
Write as much as I can. And you find, you know, you find what works, you find your voice, and you know that you're successful when somebody finishes your book and says, wow, that was great. Had a great time.
And that's exactly how I felt about the first two, and that's a great way to end. It's been a great time, as usual, talking to you. I mean, your books really impact me.
I appreciate it. I really do. I'm so appreciative of your support and your interest and your enthusiasm. It's inspiring.
Well, I think a lot of people will enjoy this book, and I hope they do. The book, again, is called Helpless. It's out from Kensington. It's in all your bookstores now. We've been talking to Daniel Palmer. We have to say goodbye, and we'll talk to you next time. Thank you, Daniel.
Terrific. Take care. Bye now.